This is She's On Call, a weekly show hosted by ENT specialist Dr. Sajana Chandrasekhar and general surgeon Dr. Marina Kurian. They'll be joined by guest experts to discuss an array of newsworthy medical and health issues. You're invited to ask the doctors anything. The physicians and their guests' views are their own and do not represent any institution. Please contact your doctor for any personal questions. Please hit share and join us live on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at She's On Call, hashtag She's On Call. Please welcome our hosts. This is She's On Call, a weekly show hosted by ENT specialist Dr. Sajana Chandrasekhar and general surgeon Dr. Marina Kurian. They'll be joined by guest experts to discuss an array of newsworthy medical and health issues. You're invited to ask the doctors anything. The physicians and their guests' views are their own and do not represent any institution. Please contact your doctor for any personal questions. Please hit share and join us live on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at She's On Call, hashtag She's On Call. Please welcome our hosts.
Hi, I'm Dr. Sajana Chandrasekhar. I'm an ear, nose, and throat surgeon in New York and New Jersey.
And I'm Dr. Marina Kurian. I'm a general surgeon in New York City area.
This week, we are not live because Marina and I are taking the United States Independence Day weekend to ourselves, and we hope you're having a great time with your family.
But if you have the time to watch, watch our highlight reel of some of the most important topics that we've discussed over the past several shows.
Next Sunday, we will be back live with our special guests, Dr. Quinn Capers and Dr. Sushmita Patti.
So enjoy the show, and we'll see you live next week.
Marina, want to talk about why we decided to start this show?
Yeah, so, you know, one thing we learned during this pandemic is that people are getting information, whether it's good information, bad information. And actually, Sujana had this great idea, like, let's do a show talking about medical topics and give people good information and some place that they can trust. And I think that based on what we hear from our patients and how successful our practices are, that people do understand what it is that we're sharing with them, that they feel comfortable, and that we are trusted by many. And certainly, this is an excellent opportunity and way to share our knowledge and actually learn from our incredible guests that we have on every week as well, so that we can share this information with the public. And I think that it's going to be topical. We also decided to call it She's On Call for a variety of reasons. And first and foremost, it's just that, you know, I'm guilty of this too. I don't know if you are, Sujana. So I'll be like, my patients are like, I'm going to go see my primary care doctor. And I'm like, oh, what's his name? And then I think to myself, or is it a woman? You know? And so I think She's On Call is just to let people know that women physicians abound, and we're here to answer your questions.
As Dr. Chandrasekhar mentioned, the numbers in the hospital definitely have decreased. At the peak of the pandemic, was working at Hackensack University Medical Center, and we, the ENT program at Rutgers University, we were redeployed to the SICU, the surgical ICU, as well as step down from it. And then I also did some shifts, night shifts, in the ICU at St. Barnabas Medical Center, helping out in the COVID ward. And it was definitely a very interesting time. I felt very rewarded, you know, helping people that were really in need. At the same time, it was pretty depressing as well, seeing a lot of people suffering and they didn't have their families at bedside. And I couldn't imagine being in that position. So I do believe that, you know, with us going through the phase one and phase two of reopening, we definitely need to continue to take the necessary precautions to protect ourselves. I know everyone's very eager to get out. I am myself. I'm a very social person, very extroverted, and I enjoy just the company of others. So I know that it'll be very difficult for most of us to kind of get back into the swing of being, you know, in the public and back into our normal, like, social settings, and also having to continue to wear masks and take the extra precautions that we didn't have to in the past pre-COVID. But I definitely think that it's very necessary. We don't want to see the spike in the number of the people being critically ill and also dying because we aren't doing our part. So I'm a huge advocate for getting back out there, but I definitely think that we have to be very careful and continue to protect ourselves. Wash our hands, as you all mentioned, wear our masks, and keep our distance.
So we've actually seen probably for almost 6 weeks a decrease in the number of cases in the ERs, which is really related to the work the New Yorkers have been doing on social distancing and mask wearing, even amongst you know, a re-expansion and open up of the economy, which has been remarkable, I think. You know, obviously, I don't know if anyone here knows this, but I actually had the coronavirus myself. And that was a really eye-opening experience for me to really feel a sense of solidarity with my patients and be able to understand the symptoms they were coming to, even if they weren't necessarily needing to be admitted to the hospital. So I now get to, you know, convey that I understand what it's like. And we see really the fewer number of patients in the ER, we're able to take really good care of them because now we know this disease much better than we did in the very beginning. In the beginning in New York, it was a tidal wave. You know, we got so many patients so fast. We had to redeploy everybody wherever we could. Everything became an ICU. And now we're much more back to a normal status quo in New York. And I'm optimistic that the work we've done and the lessons we've learned will help us reopen safely and consistently so we can ebb and flow in a way that's really mostly productive and forward moving, as opposed to what we're seeing in some states that really opened up before they had either their disease process under control or their healthcare system under control. And now they're really kind of still caught a little bit off guard. The advice I give now is very different than the advice I gave in the very beginning. The advice I give now is if you have any concern that you have the coronavirus or even have been exposed to the coronavirus, please go get tested. Because the best case scenario is a testing rate that's positive of less than 1%, in which case testing is available and ready, and we're finding all these very early symptomatic cases and really isolating people early on so they don't infect other people. Remembering that a lot of the attack mode for this virus is in isolating and identifying cases early on and then having them not be contagious to other people. So the mask wearing helps us with that early phase, right? Before you have symptoms or even in the first day of symptoms. And those symptoms really are, you know, a light cough, really a cough that's kind of a superficial cough. Maybe you have a fever up to like 101 or 100.5. Maybe you have some shortness of breath that catches you off guard. A lot of people had this sense of taste and smell that was off. I had that and I didn't know what it was. I thought I just was not having an affinity for coffee for a couple of days. And that's actually been a pretty non-specific but early on calling card for this virus. Other things are muscle aches, fatigue. So if you feel like you ran a marathon, but you really didn't, or if you're having a difficult time walking upstairs for the first time in a while, these are really symptoms that may seem odd to you. That would be a reason to go get tested. And remember that testing and finding out you're negative is not wasting a test. A lot of people are worried about that. And in New York City and in our surrounding tri-state area, our testing is abundant enough that you should get tested whenever and wherever you're concerned about being exposed or symptomatic.
It definitely took an emotional toll on me. There was one night in particular that was especially hard. I had just started a shift at St. Barnabas Medical Center. It was my evening shift that I was going to cover nights. I did cover nights and that night for. And I got there and there was this young patient who at the beginning of the shift, things looked great. We were going to transfer her out of the ICU because things were kind of on the up and up. And you know, we were really positive about the patient's progress. And unfortunately, just as the night continued on, the status of that patient just continued to deteriorate. And I remember the patient looking up at me and actually saying or asking me, am I going to die from this? And that was really, really hard. You know, I couldn't imagine it being one of my loved ones in the hospital, not able to have me there at the bedside to comfort them, let them know that I'm there. Hope, you know, and I think that having your family or patients having family around really gives them hope. And I think that has been or was the toughest part for me in the ICU is just seeing those patients there pretty much alone other than the healthcare workers there at their side. So I try to be that supportive person, but I know that it doesn't compare to actually having your, you know, loved one there.
You know, Hafia, I'm tearing up listening to you because I remember being a trainee and I remember how hard it was to learn and work my area of subspecialty, my ear, nose, and throat surgery, how difficult it was to dedicate myself entirely to that. And I find that the trainees now, this season, have unfortunately had the added burden of the emotional and intellectual challenge of learning about a disease that nobody knows anything about and that we're learning about day to day, minute to minute, and then dealing with the emotional difficulties. And I really applaud you. And I wonder what you and your fellow residents used to try to get through some of that emotional difficulty, which was both taking care of very sick and even dying patients in isolation, but also feeling like, oh my gosh, I only have this much time to learn about ENT. When am I going to do that? So how did you navigate that, or how did you and your friends navigate that?
So a couple of things. As far as trying to, I guess, stay in tune with ENT, I utilized my evenings in the surgical ICU and in the COVID ward when things were pretty quiet to read PASHA, read about ENT. And I honestly felt like it kind of kept me grounded because it was such a stressful and honestly emotionally traumatic experience that I felt like I needed something to kind of hold on to in a sense during those nights to kind of remind myself of why I chose to be, you know, there in the first place. And so that was something that kind of gave me comfort. But I would definitely say more than anything, having the support of my family, my friends, people, I always had people checking on me, asking me how was I doing, whether it was my family back home in Sudan, you know, or my family in Alabama. I had several attendings reach out and ask, like, are you okay? Do you need any sort of emotional support? And venting to me was, you know, something that was very therapeutic. again, having people that I could call, having friends that I could text in the middle of the night saying, you know, oh my gosh, this is really rough, or, you know, this was really rewarding. We, you know, one patient is doing very well and they're, you know, being sent out of the ICU.
It is, did you guys see that? I think I was on Twitter. There was some resident team that every time they extubated a patient, they would do an extubation dance. And they posted these dances, and I just loved it because it's like they were celebrating, you know, this, it's a success. And I think the thing about COVID that we've all learned, or what we call it, COVID or Corona or whatever, right, is that we just don't know. And we're learning. And as I said before, there's so much science and research that's coming out of this. And it's such an incredible step forward for research. And just, I'm just so, I would love to be involved in that research, but I'm not, because this is not what I do, right? But I just think it's just such a trove of information that it's going to be, the things we learn and the things that we learn incidentally are going to be so amazing, right? That just like, this didn't work for Corona, but now I think it's going to work for influenza, right? So it's it's good. It's such an amazing time, but it's also a super hard time.
But I think that
might be a great way to segue back to how we're going to get out,
right?
Especially the summer.
Well, I think that that's actually, for me, that's exactly the point, right? We've been able to lead with humility, at least those of us that have tried to really be leaders in this moment, to say, these are the things we know and these are the things we don't know, but we all need to live and move forward, right? But I think also a lot of us, I'm a parent of three kids. So in the middle of all of this, I've also had to figure out how to do homeschooling, get them engaged and keep them athletic and figure out what it looks like in the world to have them not understand why they're at home, why are they wearing masks. One of my kids had a liver transplant when he was 2 years old, to make it even more complicated. But the reason I bring that up is because as we re-engage over the summer, a lot of the things we think about is, what are reasonable risks we need to take as a community? What are things that are just not reasonable risks? So one of the things I talk about a lot is closed space singing, whether it's at church or a concert, is not a reasonable risk to take right now. But if you want to go to an outdoor band show and listen to an orchestra, that's probably a good idea, right? And so I think that as we reopen, I talk to my children about activities that they can partake in that are really rewarding for them, that are engaging and athletic, that keep them socially engaged with other people, but also moderate the risk they have so they're not going to in-person overnight camp in a bunk with 12 kids sleeping like sardines this summer, because we just don't know enough about the virus. Okay. So every state is doing things differently, and this is actually part of the 50 states in DC and the United States of America. So in New York State, one of the things we're doing is actually investing in contact tracers and in the process of contact tracing. And so we want people to know that if your phone rings and it is an unknown number, it may actually be a contact tracer calling you and asking you if you have symptoms or telling you you've been exposed. And that's where a lot of the training for contact tracers has happened. So we want more states to have formal contact tracing programs. One of the things I say to people is, if your community or state does not have a formal contact tracing program, that's kind of what Haifa was talking about, where you are your own contact tracer. So you need to make sure that you know who you've contacted and who you've spoken to, and really call them after you find out that either you or a family member is positive. But there are developing, thank God, in regionalities, formal contact tracing programs that will call you, not necessarily knock on your door, just let you know that you may have been exposed and that you may need to get tested. And we look forward to seeing those programs everywhere, because the three tenets of expanding safely are going to be testing, tracing, and isolating. So making sure that people that know that they have been exposed or that they're positive isolate themselves until there's been a reasonable period of time waiting for symptoms to start, or that they are negative with either multiple tests or just for a period of time.
No, thank you. That's such important information. And I think, you know, do you guys not wonder that if we're all wearing masks and we go out and we are, if we're feeling sick, we stay home and do all these things, that don't you feel like we're going to actually change perhaps our flu season and our cold season?
Yeah.
Right? There's going to be some good coming out of this, I think.
A lot. We don't see, I mean, I had a patient strep throat yesterday for the first time in weeks, right? And strep itself is generally as our ENT doctor will tell you, not always contagious, right? It sometimes can be just a manifestation of what you have in your, you live, that lives in your body. But we have not seen a lot of other respiratory viruses. Even we saw like a massive downswap of the flu virus in March and April because of the masks. And we've also seen, and this is, I think, really inspiring, is this Missouri hairdresser case, I think, is so fascinating, where you had two hairdressers that were symptomatic and in close contact with people. 140 people were exposed in theory, but the hairdresser and the customer were both wearing masks, and none of them were, got the coronavirus. None. Which I think is so exciting as far as an opportunity to do something without waiting for a vaccine or more medication, because prevention in this case is so key on the idea of getting back to normal, engaging with our communities, and getting back to an economy that's going to move forward.
And that's a critical point, right? Livelihoods of so many different, you know, in New York, what do they say about restaurants? It's location, location, location. But really now, when so many of them have shuttered their doors, it's going to be a completely different landscape. And I think it's so critical that we do restart the world. It has to restart.
You know, I think it's not that hard to wear a mask, and it's not that hard to care about other people in your community. And frankly, if all we need to do to get back to work and get back to life is to wear a mask and keep our distance and wash our hands, I think we're going to be okay. I, you know, a lot of people are writing in, and it's so amazing to see. Laureen Looney says, awesome idea. Congratulations on a new show. Thank you. Bose George, who's writing from Eastern Long Island, says, great show. Thank you. Allison O'Connor is congratulating us on the information that all of us ladies are providing. People writing from Chicago, people writing from California, from all over the place, which is really great. I wonder, because, you know, one of our premises for She's on Call is that even though women are present in medical school and women physicians are no longer an aberration, I think, you know, the sort of the go-to is the male doctor. And I'm wondering if you guys might share a little bit of your journey to medicine with us. And maybe I'll ask you, Hafia, just, you know, how did this come about? Who are you? How'd you get here? What are your dreams? How, let's know about you.
Yes. So my story is, like, I guess a little cliche. You know, I grew up always wanting to be a doctor, kind of thing. Once I got into medical school, which I went to the Alabama College of Osteopathic Medicine and graduated there. I never really even imagined myself being a surgeon, to be honest. But I actually met an ENT after my first year of medical school and worked with him. And I fell in love. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is 100% for me. And it's interesting because most of the inspirations that I had to even become a physician and then, you know, even a surgeon were males. They were male doctors that I kind of looked to. But, you know, I saw that I was fully capable of doing the same and providing aid and help to those who really need it. I'm a giver at heart. And so I just knew that it was the right profession for me. But as I've gone through my journey, finishing medical school and then matching into residency, I've had the opportunity to meet several wonderful surgeons, such as you, Dr. Chandra Shaker, that have really inspired me to work hard, achieve my goal, and really kind of change the narrative. A lot of people just automatically assume, and we're all guilty of it, even myself, you know, where we, if you're speaking to a patient and the patient says, oh, well, my doctor is so-and-so, you say, oh, well, what did he say? You know, we automatically, you know, assume that it's a male, but, and so we're all guilty of it, but I hope that we can all work together to change that. I'm commonly called a nurse, which nurses are amazing. I love them. I've learned so much and will continue to learn throughout my journey of training and even when I am practicing on my own. But at the same time, I do think that, you know, society has kind of made it to where in our minds we think that, you know, men should be the physicians, women should be the nurses. And I'm so happy to have leaders such as you all, to look to, and hopefully others that are viewing this as well will feel empowered and inspired that us women, we make a huge difference in healthcare, and we're very important. So I'm excited to have this opportunity, and I hope that I have inspired someone out there.
That's wonderful. Dara, your journey?
Oh, I'm old now, so it takes a little longer.
Not as old as me.
So my mom's a nurse too, actually. So both of you guys mentioned how your parents were inspiring and in the healthcare field. My mom was a nurse, and she actually worked in the ER at a trauma center when I was a kid, and I thought that was the coolest thing in the entire world. If in July 4th your hand got blown off by a firecracker, I wanted to be the one to figure out how to put it back together, but not too long. I wanted to then move on to the next patient. So I, speed tracked, and it became, went to college, med school, the whole nine yards, and went right into emergency medicine, showed up in the ER my first day at Kings County and said, as a medical student, not as a resident, and said, I'm here to be a doctor, train me. And I spent a lot of time in that ER learning incredible things from an incredible faculty. I've spent a lot of time working on gender equity in medicine and really kind of reframing the narrative around what does a doctor look like, and more importantly, how do we live as physicians with other lives? I think one of the historical mandates of physicians and really a lot of other professionals was to lean forward and go, move on without really a distraction of anything else in your life. And I think once women really hit critical mass in medicine, we started really kind of incorporating our other societal gender, based, responsibilities, and really had to reframe what does it look like to take parental leave, or what does it look like to have, to be pregnant at work and have a hierarchy that really did not promote women, did not pay them fairly, did not really amplify their voices. And the best way for me to do that was to bring together really a community of women and have them start speaking to each other so that they could then amplify each other and really be a force to be reckoned with. And so I spent probably the last 7 or 8 years doing research on gender equity, really creating a speakers bureau for women in medicine and getting the voices of women out there, not just women, but really then intersectional and diverse across the board, making sure that we then, our traditional physician is not just male, but he's also white and he's, cisgender and he's heterosexual and he's all these things that we expect norms to look like. And so a lot of equity comes in making opportunities for people at the intersections. And that's a lot of what I've done. And I think that we've seen a reframe, and the coronavirus, to bring this all together, has really taught a lot of us about what it's like to live as a whole person. And I think schooling and homeschooling has done a great opportunity for that as well, because a lot of us have started to realize that the tasks that it took to be a parent and, a Zoom school teacher while also working from home made us realize that there were things we were missing out on, but also things that we needed to kind of make space for in the future. And so we'll see a lot more flexible working, I think job sharing and opportunities for workplace space that will create a better equitable principles aside from a reframed healthcare work environment, reframed economy, and other kind of principles that I think will hopefully bring us closer to diversity and inclusion and long-term solutions.
So I live in Houston, Texas, and we obviously, Texas is having it's a major wave right now of COVID. I personally am managing okay. I have a very strict decontamination process when I go home to my children. So the nanny knows that when I get home, she hides them. I have an outdoor shower, and I have clean scrubs on that I take off and treat as they are dirty and completely decontaminate, and then brush my teeth and, Listerine the whole. And then I come in and interact with my children. I know some of my colleagues are living away from their families at the time so that they don't infect them if they happen to be pre-symptomatic. But we're managing okay. So far, it's working for us.
Your children are beautiful. And I have to tell everyone, I knew Nadia when she was an anesthesia resident up in Mount Sinai. And she was a crackerjack then. And your car has just zoomed. So I'm so glad you could make the time. How about you, Leland? How are you doing?
Yeah, so I'm currently in Washington, D.C., starting my fifth-year residency. And D.C. has actually done a really good job flattening the curve. People are staying home, working from home, and our cases are pretty low in the hospital. But I agree with Nadia. I decontaminate. There's a whole process when I get home. And so far, my close ones have been safe, and hopefully they'll stay that way.
Nadia, why do you think, what's happened in Texas? And, you know, when we were at our peak in New York, some of our hospitals were, the ICUs were overflowing. The operating rooms became ICUs. That happened certainly at one of my institutions that I go to, and then several in the city. And then also what we found, and you went to Mount Sinai, so you know, Queens got hit super hard, the Bronx as well, and then Columbia up in Washington Heights area, that also got hit. And so they had to create, you know, ICUs out of rooms, and it was a, there, that's when we saw our resources being overutilized, and that was when we were all sort of worried that what's going to happen if this gets worse. And so that when we flatten the curve, which, you know, is everybody sick of saying flattening the curve? Because probably we are. But once we did that, I think it made a huge difference in terms of decreasing our utilization. So when you guys are on the uptick in Houston, or is it all over Texas? So many questions. Go ahead.
It is. I think it's focused mostly on the big cities in Texas. I think part of the problem was the early reopening without having an understanding that we needed to do it safely. The mask situation in Texas is a big deal. The mayors of all the different big cities were advocating for enforcing mask use. However, the governor sort of countered them, saying that we're infringing on people's rights. And I want to say that was probably interpreted as it's not that important. So what we were seeing in Texas is people were, you know, congregating, not wearing masks. And as a result, we are about to be in a situation where, you know, New York was a couple of weeks ago, where we're overwhelmed, many hospitals are at capacity, we're starting to become overwhelmed. And although we have the advantage of having space, we could probably create thousands of ICU beds. The issue is now, who's going to staff those ICUs? We don't have thousands of nurses just laying around, not doing anything, and doctors and respiratory therapists, et cetera. So I don't know, we're about to be where New York was, I think.
You know, it was really hard up here. Not only did we face a paucity of like the trained healthcare workers, nurses, doctors, respiratory therapists, as you said, but even patient transport, linen. One of the audiologists, the people who test hearing here, you know, she was dragged in to do linen and laundry in the hospital because somebody had to fold the linens and wash the linens so that patients could have their bedding changed. One of the other audiologists was pulled in, and if you called the switchboard in the hospital, you're like, hey, Lisa, what are you doing answering the phone? Because we need people at every level, and that's what we saw here. And we really hoped that the rest of the country learned from that. And I think the injection of politics into healthcare made the science not heard as well as it should. You know, even my mom, who's a physician, she's like, oh, come on. All you guys are saying is, you know, wear a mask, wash your hands, keep distance. Wear a mask, wash your hands, keep distance. But that's actually the best medicine right now. And we've done it up here in the Northeast. And we're seeing that flattening of the curve that we talked about, you know, in March. And unfortunately, we're seeing that curve rise in many cities. What's going on in D.C., Lilan?
So in D.C., like I mentioned briefly, things are, people are really abiding by the rules. The streets are fairly empty. People are wearing masks out and about. And I think our hospital did a great job acquiring protective personal equipment for the healthcare workers. Initially, in the beginning, you know, the masks were kind of put in separate areas so people wouldn't bring them home. And, you know, we were all kind of dealing with using N95s during the day all the time, but now it's kind of just become part of the routine. We're getting our PPE when we need them. And then in terms of our ancillary staff, they were originally sent to do some other jobs. Like some of our techs were sent to do fever checks at the front of the hospital. But for now, I think our volume has gone back to normal and they're back to their original positions.
we have seen this COVID pandemic grip our country, and then we saw the extremely harrowing, horrible murder of Mr. George Floyd, and we saw these uprisings in the street. And, you know, as physicians, you know, we'd spent months saying, you know, stay away, social distance, wear masks, and we saw, for the most part, the protesters were peaceful and were wearing masks and were in fact outdoors where it's a little less dangerous. But we did see some action with what's called rubber bullets, with tear gas. And Lilan, maybe you can explain your experience and what prompted you to write this really eloquent op-ed in the Washington Post shortly after the June 1st Lafayette Park occurrences.
Sure. So basically, I was on call that Monday night where the Lafayette Square shooting happened. And, you know, just kind of as a background, it was a day where most of you guys saw President Trump on camera giving a speech about what was going on in light of the George Floyd incident. And, you know, honestly, for me, I was in clinic till pretty late, and I wanted to get home on time before the curfew. There was a curfew set by Mayor Bowser in D.C. for 7 p.m. And just around the time that I got home, around 7, I was called by the emergency room, and they said there was a patient who had been shot by a rubber bullet while in Lafayette Square, and they wanted me to come in to evaluate him. So I looked on the CT from my house, and it was already very surprising just from the CT scan that there was a penetrating wound through this man's chin all the way to his bone, to his jawbone about here. And, you know, I've never seen a rubber bullet before. I've seen regular gunshot wounds, but, you know, rubber bullets aren't really used in public generally, unless it's, you know, in these particular circumstances. So I looked it up on Wikipedia and found out that, you know, they're not just rubber. They have fragments of plastic, they have fragments of metal, and the rubber is just kind of the coating around the bullet. And, you know, when I went in, I wasn't really sure what to expect. So I saw the patient, you know, really gaping wound in his chin, and I ended up having to debride kind of the metal fragments, the plastic fragments out of his chin. Thankfully, it didn't really penetrate the bone and it didn't cause a bony fracture. So everything I did was at bedside, and he was really tolerant of me doing all that. And I closed him, sutured him back up and sent him home. So that was kind of the circumstance of what happened.
Dr. Kuntz had been at Stanford for 19 years, had done her internship, her residency, her postgraduate training, was on staff there, and wrote on Twitter that as she moved up, she faced such gender harassment because of her success that she could not abide it any longer. She was grateful to those who were supportive of her, her patients, her colleagues, but she couldn't abide it and she left. And she's going over to Yale now, starting July 1st, which for those of you who don't know, that's the beginning of our academic year in medicine. And when we looked into this, you know, JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, had a study on self-reported sexual harassment in academic medicine. And women reported 30% of women reported sexual harassment, whereas only 4% of male physicians did. So this is women physicians in academics versus male physicians. And of the women who reported the harassment, 40% said it was severe, 59% said it decreased their confidence, and 47% said that it caused negative career effects. And, you know, it really pains me that in 2020, this is what we're talking about still. And I wonder, either Lilan or Nadia, if you feel comfortable talking about either your experiences or experiences you've seen other people have, or ways, in fact, that you are trying to combat this where you are. And I know, Nadia, your institution has a beautiful diversity initiative going on.
Yeah, I think many women experience this, and a lot of us are very, we're sort of afraid to talk about it for fear of repercussion. So myself included, you can imagine somebody who looks like me, a young female, appears to be single because I don't share my personal life. I get a lot of inappropriate comments. One time, a surgeon, sorry, it was no surgeons, but a surgeon called into the operating room where I was working and asked the resident, my resident, if I was single and if I would go out with him while I was at work, which, you know, I'm loud and I'm not afraid to share my opinion. So that didn't go very well. But these things happen. And it's unfortunate that we have to deal with this day and age. But luckily for us, we do have each other to support each other. And I have a lot of he for she's behind me, which help, you know, bring me up and redirect me when I get distracted by this negativity. So I just stick with my group of supporters and drown out.
It can be sexual harassment, but as we also say, it's like a gender discrimination as well, where you're not allowed opportunities if you're female, or if you're underrepresented minority, or if for whatever reason someone just doesn't like you, they don't really need a reason. And this used to happen in the old days way more often, I believe. I know that that slide was actually from University of Michigan. They have an incredible initiative for hiring creating a diverse department and keeping that diversity on every level, at every committee level within the institution. I have good friends that are there and they've done just a spectacular job. Lilan, do you think, I would say that for myself in my training, I could see where the guys and the girls were treated a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. And I think it also depended on the personality of the individual. And I don't know, I didn't feel that I was necessarily discriminated against at all. I was also more of a tomboy. So, you know, I don't know if that made a difference or not. And I think nowadays in training, Lilan, if you could tell us how you feel.
So it's interesting because when I was an intern, probably 4 years ago, I was part of an intern class that was all men. And that included, you know, we were surgical interns, so it was general surgery, orthopedic surgery, urology, neurosurgery, and it was just myself and one other female intern, and she was a neurosurgery intern. So, you know, we had an intern room where we did a lot of kind of chart checking and doing daily, you know, like note writing, et cetera. And it just felt kind of like a boys' locker room. No one was explicitly sexist or anything. And I felt like for the most part, I was comfortable being there, but just in surgery generally, there are so many men at all levels that we tend to be the minority. And you know, depending on the personality, like you were saying, if you were more comfortable, like if you were a tomboy or something, you probably fit in better into the locker room culture. But obviously I think the more diverse, both the attending and resident classes can be, the more inclusive, you know, the program can be.
Yeah, I will tell you, one day we'll dish and we'll talk about all the horrible experiences because they were horrible. And I was so sad to see this week because the horrible experiences that happened in the 80s and the 90s to people like me should not still be happening in 2020. I remember our little call room. The boys put up all these Playboy centerfolds. So one of the drug reps asked me what I'd like, and I said, I would like a copy of Playgirl. Back in those days, the Playgirl centerfolds actually wore underwear because we were apparently very modest, even when we were sexual. And I just put up the Playgirl centerfold, and immediately the Playboy centerfolds came down because I was like, I can't ask you guys to not make this disgusting, so I'm going to make it more disgusting, and then everything came down. And I think you have to be a little bit tough to do that. AJ Nathan, who is a rising third-year medical student at Boston University, wrote, we need more women leadership, and women are now the majority in medical school. We're about 51% of medical students, and we need to see that better reflected at the top. And talk about he for she, I think that we have so many male advocates that makes it easier or less difficult for us to confront the male bullies that we encounter. I had one guy, I mean, my residency was, you know, when wheels were square and there were no women almost in the residency program. And one of the guys in, I had spent 2 or 3 months with him on vascular surgery, and he sat me down on the last day and he said, you know, he was really disgusting. He would say dead baby jokes. He would say all gross jokes, but sometimes they were funny. So I'd come back the next day and I'd say, oh, I told my dad that joke. That was kind of funny. And he'd look at me funny. And at the end of 3 months, he said to me, I've been trying to make you cry for 3 months. And I said, oh, you should have wasted your time. You should have told me to cry on day one. I would have cried. We'd have been done. You know, like, I don't understand that statement, but sorry for you, because that's a big waste of your time. But I think that these biases, whether they happen because of gender, because of ethnicity, because of sexual orientation, our LGBTQ brothers and sisters are experiencing this. I hope that by having more diverse leadership as we go forward, we are able to avoid this very unnecessary part of training and part of life. And I do think, Nadia and Lilun, you know, when you talk about your experiences, I think there are not only he for she, but there is a lot of women who support other women. There are a lot of women we can go to in our hospitals who will hear and see when guys might not hear or see. And I think, you know, ensuring that we are not mistreated by our patients or by our colleagues is really important. This is a Twitter feed from Professor Vishal Mishra at Columbia. And he just looked at what would happen in the states that did not mandate masks if they did mandate masks. And you can see that the red graph that goes straight up in terms of number of cases is in states where masks are not mandated, whereas the curve would in fact be flat or blue if the states did mandate masks.
I think that's such an incredible graphic, right? So the red is what's actually happening, and the blue is what would have happened if they had just said, wear a dang mask. You know, wear the mask. How hard is that? And yeah. I think that's so important. I think people should really note that. This could be our most important takeaway from our show, is that if you wore a mask, that this explosion of cases in all the hard hit areas would not be happening.
So, you know, when you wear a mask, you have to wear it properly. So I'm just going to do a little tutorial for people who don't know.
Yeah, she's a ENT, so we're going to follow what she said.
So here's a mask. This happens to be a surgical mask. There's a top and a bottom, which is the top has this metal band on it, and the bottom does not. There's an outside, which is blue, and an inside, which is white. The way you put this on is you put it on, hook it over your ears, and you pinch over your nose the metal strap. You pull it over the bridge of your nose and under your chin. If it's loose on the sides, you can actually twist this and put it over your ears to make that tight. What you want is an airtight seal. When you remove your mask, remove it like this. Don't touch the inside or the outside, and hang it somewhere to dry. One of my friends asked me if they could microwave this surgical mask. You could if you want to start a fire in your microwave. So don't do that.
No, but people were talking about how you could put it in the oven at like 140 degrees. And
no,
even healthcare professionals. So it seems that certain masks, you can do that and get away with it, and you don't see smoking or deterioration of the mask. And this was really going on when we had so many PPE shortages, and they were like, use your mask for the week. If you see it break down, then you'll get a new one. You know, I mean, that's pretty dramatic. So you want to kind of try and sterilize it if you can. And so that's where this whole temperature thing came up. But certain masks you cannot put in the oven or the microwave.
Yeah. And you can frankly just hang these up to dry and they're fine unless they're soiled. If you have a cloth mask and if it keeps slipping down, you can actually put a pipe cleaner, our old you know, pipe cleaner from elementary school arts and crafty. And so screw that into your mask, and that'll act as a pinch. And then, of course, the cloth mask can be washed in hot water. We have a number of questions that many of our readers have asked, and we really appreciate it. Please like and share and subscribe and tell your friends and send in questions. Good morning. We're going to, you know, I'm going to do a self-plug. I have a bunch of videos about COVID that I thought were outdated that I made in March and April, and they're certainly not outdated because we're still in that first wave. Yeah. But you can find them on my YouTube channel, which is Dr. Dr. Sujana, which is my first name, Dr. Sujana. And you can just look at them and laugh at me, but you might learn some tips. But I think the other questions we can actually ask with our guests. So maybe Marina, you want to bring our guests on?
Yeah, so first I'll invite Dr. Jordana Cohen. She's an assistant professor of medicine and nephrology at University of Pennsylvania. So thank you so much for joining us, Jordy. And then Dr. Olga Garcia is a chief resident out in, I want to say it's Ojai and Ventura, right, in California. And she's also a second lieutenant in the Air Force. So it's going to be great to get a couple of perspectives, both from, you know, the hospital from Olga, but also like what's happening in the military. It'd be wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us, you guys.
We're really glad to have you. We're really happy to have you. We have people. We have Ermin Hiro watching from Finland. We have Mark Lee watching from North Carolina. We have people watching from New Jersey. We have Alamelu Iyengar watching from Northern California. We've got people watching from India. We're very grateful that Scroll.in is broadcasting us on their channels. This is, as you know, a global pandemic. We want to talk about, hello, Delisa, my friend from Nicaragua. I do medical missions, or when I could travel, I did medical missions in Nicaragua. And it's a beautiful country with beautiful people, and unfortunately facing a huge explosion in cases with lack of PPE. So we are not out of the woods. I know that Jordy and Olga, we want to talk about your subspecialties, but we also want to talk about your take on COVID.
I want to ask, we should answer, we mentioned Mark Lee, like he had a question about what we're going to do now that it's fireworks season, and also you're going to see, all these social gatherings of more than 10 people or 25 people. And so what are we going to see in terms of COVID and also firework injuries, right?
Right. So, I mean, I'm going to jump in just because my friend Ben Chang, who's at University of Pennsylvania, does hand and microsurgery. And he texted me Thursday. He said, please make this PSA on your show. We are seeing so many fireworks injuries. People are just blowing off fireworks every night all over the place. And because many of the big shows with professionals are canceled, people are taking it upon themselves to use fireworks. He just took care of somebody who blew off both of their hands. Are doing in your area that are either good or bad?
Yeah, I have heard the fireworks going off for the last couple of weeks, all around us really. And I think in this particular area, I would definitely caution anyone to participate in those things because there's such a high risk of wildfires. It's been really dry, and we've already had around 5 fires locally that, required a lot of resources to put out. So, and the fire season is just beginning. So it's very worrisome. But certainly personal injuries are not desirable either.
Yeah, that is such an important other fact, right? Because California, you guys, not only forest fires or shrub fires, right? You also have mudslides and all these other things that we don't really think about as in New York City area, but critical to really add to the firework safety protocol, because forest fires and those shrub fires can be so devastating and especially where you are, Olga. Like, was it just last year or was it 2 years ago? I mean, it was, fires burning all around Ventura, Ojai, everywhere. It was just an encroaching, and so much land was burned, and I'm sure it's not recovered yet.
Yeah, that was, I think it was 2 years ago in December, the Thomas fire happened, and, you know, lots of people were evacuated, lots of people lost their homes and all their personal belongings. So it was a big deal.
So maybe Jordy, we can talk about some other things people are doing. I don't know if you're aware, the FDA just released an advisory against sort of these cut rate or low cost hand sanitizers that have methanol in them instead of ethyl alcohol. And I wonder if you can talk as an internist, as a nephrologist, and as somebody who understands statistics really well, what people should be worried about if they're buying these sort of cut rate or off brand hand sanitizers. There's a particular company called Eskion, I think we're going to have the link to it, to the FDA advisory, but maybe you can talk to us about what they should be concerned about.
Yeah, thank you. That's right, very, very close to home for me. I've dialyzed off more methanol toxicities than I would like to say. And so it's something that I think is really important for people to be aware of is we know methanol is toxic. And we know, for instance, we always think of it as people drinking moonshine, where they think that it's ethanol, that there is methanol in it. 12 to 24 hours later, they end up blind and presenting to an emergency room with nausea and vomiting and with mania is sort of the typical presentation we're used to. What I think most people aren't aware of is that you can actually get methanol toxicity from absorption. And so several hand sanitizers, if they're not created in the correct capacity, they're prone to the similar issues as moonshine in terms of distilling alcohol and ethanol. You can have a higher proportion of methanol than you would want in more than any methanol in hand sanitizers can result in toxicity through absorption. And so it's very important to be careful and to make sure that you know where you're obtaining your hand sanitizers from.
So this particular company, this Esk Biochem, which is a Mexican company, was warned by the FDA, but has not pulled their products. And I'm very concerned. You know, Marina and I were talking earlier today, and all the hand sanitizers are getting sold out again. And so you want to make sure that you could take a screenshot of this. You go to the FDA website. They have this advisory. Please don't buy these products, because you would think, yeah, you have to drink it or you have to inhale it, but you actually just on your skin, right, Jordy? Is that what you're saying?
Yep, you can get it through absorption. You can get methanol toxicity, and it's the same methanol toxicity that you would see with people drinking it. Wow. It breaks down to formaldehyde and formic acid, and it can result in irreversible blindness and this and other negative effects that you would have from formaldehyde and formic acid in your body. It has to be dialyzed off to correct these issues within 12 to 24 hours. And if you do not get urgent dialysis and fomepizole in that time, then the damage is often permanent.
You know, we hear a lot about dialysis, and we hear a lot about dialysis with COVID-19. I wonder if you could step back and just try to explain to our audience what that means. What is dialysis? How do you do it? You know, simple, but maybe something we all need to understand better.
Yeah, with pleasure. I'll give a sort of a brief lay explanation of what dialysis is. And so I'm a nephrologist by trade. So I'm a kidney doctor, and I also create research studies and interpret data related to both kidney disease and high blood pressure. Dialysis is a major aspect of what I do. Dialysis is a procedure that is done to clean the blood when somebody's kidneys aren't working, and it replaces the function of the kidney. Your kidneys have two very critical roles. One is to remove important toxins from your body, and this is really the only time that I approve of people using the term toxins, because often that term is misused in the press. And so really only in the concept of removing them for dialysis is when we approve of that term. And the other purpose of dialysis is to remove fluid from your body, because as we all know, our kidneys produce urine, and they're the reason that we are able to get a lot of the fluid off of our body by urinating. And when your kidneys no longer function or are in failure, you cannot produce enough high quality or quantity urine. And so dialysis takes over that task and helps to remove extra fluid as well. And so in COVID-19 patients, and in many severe diseases, but more so in COVID-19, we see people when they're very, very sick because your kidneys are very prone to shock and they can stop working as a result of many infections, but we think more so in COVID-19 for several reasons, because there's higher risk of clotting, there's higher risks of very severe immune responses in COVID-19 that the kidneys are particularly sensitive to. And so we end up seeing that a lot of patients have to receive a special type of dialysis who have COVID-19, which is a gentle continuous dialysis, where we're not just giving people a usual dialysis, which is typically a short procedure that's done through the bloodstream, where somebody has a large IV placed either in their neck or in their groin, and we do a procedure for about typically 4 hours, about three times a week. Instead, in COVID-19, and what we see in very, very severe and scary illnesses, is we do something that's a continuous dialysis. It's much gentler on the body, but it's an indicator that somebody is much more critically ill when we have to do that. And something unique to COVID-19 also that we're seeing with this dialysis is that, first of all, we had a lot of shortages for quite a period of time, especially during the surges in New York, where we couldn't get a lot of the materials, a lot of the fluids we need to adequately perform dialysis. So even when patients would have normally been able to be treated with it, we were sharing devices across patients and not giving them the usual level that we would normally want to be giving them because we were so short on materials. But then also on top of that, we were on top of that, the devices just weren't working. They're clotting off. There are a lot of other issues that are very unique to COVID and creates very, very big challenges in adequately treating people. It's very scary.
Yeah, you brought up that there were shortages.
So here's the CDC guideline on how to wear a mask. So cover your nose, cover your chin. It's not to be worn over your neck or under your nose with your nose sticking out, or above your mouth with your mouth sticking out. So, you know, the first question, do masks work? And I'm going to answer that. Yeah, they protect other people from you if you are an asymptomatic carrier. And maybe, Olga, I'm going to ask you, do masks deplete your oxygen?
They do not. So as someone who wears a mask all day, pretty much every day, you know, in the operating room, I've never had any issues. You know, I'm standing up, operating. I've never passed out, anything like that. So, you know, now we're wearing them around the hospital at all times, and I still take the stairs, and it's a non-issue. So I think that's a very unfortunate myth that's been circulating around the media, and we have to put an end to it.
And then I'm going to ask Jordy, maybe you can talk to our viewers about the difference between a surgical mask, a cloth mask, and an N95. People are very confused about what to wear and who wears what.
Yeah, it's a good point. And so they're all designed for different purposes. And N95 has some very, very cool technology behind it that allows it to block out 95% of particles that would go through it. That's why it's called N95. And it's really meant, they really need to be preserved for healthcare providers and people who are most exposed to aerosolized virus, because there's a huge nationwide shortage of them. There's going to continue to be a huge worldwide shortage of them because very few machines can actually make them in the world. And the purpose for those is to protect the people who are going to be most exposed, who you need to be around to save you when you get the virus. And so those really have to be preserved for healthcare workers. Surgical masks are the next best thing. They are high quality in terms of preventing any particles from leaving from your mouth to go outside, but they don't protect you from other things coming in and affecting you. But they are quite effective in terms of protecting other people around you from getting any kind of infectious particles from the person wearing them. That's why surgeons have worn them for decades. As you are all surgeons, more not myself, but that's why we wear them in sterile procedures. That's why masks have been shown tried and true in many, many circumstances to prevent infection very, very effectively. Cloth masks aren't as good. Depending on the type of material, they're much more prone to being porous. But when everyone wears them, it still prevents infection substantially. And there's a paper that had come out a couple of months ago that had demonstrated this. If you have people where somebody has it and both the person who's not infected and the person who is infected both are wearing a cloth mask, you still have a much, much lower risk of infecting each other, about a 2% risk of infecting each other. Both are wearing masks, even if it's just cloth masks. And so they do really make a difference. It's just not going to be as good, of course, as wearing these higher quality masks, but every bit counts a huge amount, especially on a population level. And the other thing to keep in mind too, by the way, the N95 masks, a lot of people have the ones with valves that they wear that have been used for protecting people from dust particles, for instance, when cleaning houses, so that when you breathe out, particles can come out of your mouth, but it protects you from having particles come in. Those are not good. Those should not be worn, because all you're doing by wearing that is protecting yourself from dust particles and potentially making other people at risk of catching your coronavirus.
This is a video that Nina Shapiro, who is an otolaryngologist at UCLA, put on her Twitter feed. And this is somebody literally blowing a candle through one of those N95s with the valve. We have just a couple of minutes left, so maybe I can ask you guys for top three of what each of you think people should know about your field. And maybe we'll start with Olga. What are the top three important things that patients or people should know about general surgery and maybe colorectal surgery?
So one of the things that we always talk with patients about is colorectal cancer screening. It's really important because we are able to find colorectal polyps and actually remove them entirely before they ever have a chance of developing into a cancer. So, some of the other screening tests are not as good because even if we do identify a problem, like there's blood in the stool that's microscopic, we still have to do a colonoscopy to actually identify the source of it. So if you just get a colonoscopy, then you can be done within a day and kind of put your mind at ease.
And Olga, what's the age? What age should people get colonoscopy?
So in general, we recommend 50 years old as a starting age for screening colonoscopies. But if there's any family history of colorectal cancer, then it should be done earlier, depending on when your relative was diagnosed.
Jordy, any final thoughts before we go to our credits?
Your kidneys are the source of your high blood pressure. They're often the source of a lot of heart disease, so just don't forget the importance of them. If you have high blood pressure, if you have other medical issues, make sure you're still following with your primary care doctor during this time, because so many people are putting aside these other chronic issues as though they're not important as COVID. And this is what we're worried about, is what if the second or third or fourth surge is going to be more people coming in with heart attacks, coming in with kidney failure, who weren't seeking out the chronic care that they needed.
Thanks, Jordy. I want to thank all of you guys who are watching. Please do share again. We have @SheesOnCall and our hashtag is SheesOnCall on Twitter. But share with your friends. This is something that we're going to do weekly. And of course, I want to thank our producers for the show, and also want to thank Scroll In for sharing our show with their viewership. They are one of the largest organizations, actually now worldwide, right? But in India as well. And it's a news organization, and they've been able to share our show with their viewership. So I want to thank them.
On July 12th, we'll be back live, Sunday, July 12th, 11 a.m. to 12 noon Eastern time. And we will be very pleased to have Dr. Quinn Capers, a cardiologist and big proponent of understanding diversity and understanding implicit bias in medicine and surgery. And Dr. Sushmita Patti, who is at Stony Brook, and she is a pediatrician who runs their primary care pediatrics and is also the medical consultant for the Alan Alda Institute of Communicating, so about teaching others about things. And speaking of teaching others, Irma Chavez from Alexandria, Virginia writes, please tell people COVID-19 is real. Yes, people, COVID-19 is real. Please wash your hands, maintain social distance, wear a mask so we can see each other in person. The four of us, instead of staring at our computers, could actually be having a cup of tea. And that's going to happen when we all take this disease seriously.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks again, everyone who's watching. Jordy, one of the comments is they love your Millennium Falcon in the background. I didn't even notice it. I was like, oh, my God. That's wonderful.
You're going to be on tape. The recording is going to be available right after this is over. So if you like our show and you feel like somebody else needs to watch it, please tag them and let them know and share and like and follow and all those words that I keep getting confused about social media. We are so very proud of our colleagues, Dr. Jordy Cohen, Dr. Olga Garcia, for everything that you're doing. Keep up the good work, and we'll see each other in person soon. Have a great week, everybody.
All right. Bye, everyone.
Thank you.